The Rank Agribusiness Institute originated with a gift from the Rank family of Sun Prairie to coordinate agribusiness teaching, research, and extension outreach activity on the UW-Madison campus. Professor Randy Fortenberry is director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. And Extension is really pleased to have him with us today to talk about a little bit about the economics of biofuels and bioenergy, and maybe to talk about some research that's going on relating to it on the UW-Madison campus and elsewhere for that matter, too. So if you have some questions as we talk biofuels and bioenergy with our guest, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. And Randy, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today.
No problem.
This is a joint program, isn't it? It's UW-Madison.
The Rank Agribusiness Institute? Yeah, it's UW-Madison, UW Extension. It's an affiliation with the Business School and the College of Ag and Life Sciences on the Madison campus.
Yeah, and the as we think about biofuels, I think it's seen by many people as a way to revitalize rural communities. Not, that may or may not be a correct assumption, but that's what a lot of people think.
Yeah, that's one of the, probably if you look at the major public policy focuses, that's one of the real reasons that that we've gotten involved with public policy, trying to look at how this industry might move forward. It is a way to bring relatively high-paying jobs to local communities. There's challenges as well, but it has been looked at as a way to add value to production that's already going on in these communities and to capitalize on value-added industries and bring relatively well-paying jobs.
Yeah, and it has done that in many communities. We're seeing a little, I don't know, I'm not sure what the proper term is, but we're seeing a little bit of some problems in terms of the ethanol, at least on the horizon with investments and so forth. With some of the ethanol companies or some of the places that went heavily into it are facing some problems. Maybe you could talk about why would that be the case?
Well, it's a commodity business, which means where you get your ethanol doesn't really matter as a consumer. And in any commodity business, we see cycles. So prices respond to overall production. We've had a lot of investment in production capacity. We have looked at ways to encourage consumption, and those strategies have been successful. The Renewable Fuels Act that was passed in 2005, a lot of state strategies, but we also have grown capacity tremendously, and as that happens, the price is affected. My sense is that some of the price decline we've seen over the last 50 or 60 days, which has been significant, is somewhat of a temporary situation as we sort of sort through how we're going to distribute. One thing that's happened with this industry is we've grown production capacity quicker than our ability to handle the distribution. You know, we get a lot of talk about investing in the local community, building production capacity, talking to consumers about why they may want to use the product, but there's actually some infrastructure frictions associated with distributing from a rural community where it's produced to an urban community where it's consumed, and so we have some bottlenecks we need to work through as we move forward.
Yeah, and as you think about that, something like ethanol doesn't move. You can't move it the same way that you can move oil, for example.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It has a couple challenges. We don't ship it through pipelines for various reasons. If you think about our entire transportation system since 1982 or so, when we deregulated the rail industry's moved towards a system that they try to move a lot of cars in a very short period of time, hauling bulk commodities. And what we've invested in largely are, in the Midwest, for example, cars to haul grain products, not cars to haul liquids. And so as the industry's developing, and before it can fill 124 cars in 24 hours at a single plant, they face some challenges getting rolling stock to move the product. They face some challenges with transportation costs of delivery. And so there's issues that we're going to have to sort of work through with the supporting industries as the biofuels industry grows.
Yeah, sure. How many plants do we have, ethanol plants do we have in the U.S.? I think it's 100 and some, 100 and...
Yeah, it grows every day. I think we have about 129 that are actually on the books now. And a couple months ago, we might have said 119. So we're adding plant capacity continuously. There's 76 that I think is the most recent number that are currently under construction, another 10 or so that are looking at major expansion. So we have added significant capacity in the last 24 months or so.
Yeah. How many plants do we have in Wisconsin?
I think we have about 8 in Wisconsin, but we have 7 or 8 online, and we have almost that many that are being looked at as new projects.
Okay. Professor Randy Fortenberry, our guest today, is director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute in the Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension, talking about the economics of biofuels and bioenergy with him today. Certainly, if you want to join in, the number to call for you is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Nationally, I was trying to remember production. We've got all these plants. How much are we producing?
I think at the end of this year, we will probably have produced just under 7 billion gallons, which is a big increase over last year. I think last year it was close to 4, something like that. So a lot of production increase in the last 12 or 13 months.
So, and let's try and put that into some sort of perspective before we go to the phones. That's a lot. That's a 8 billion gallons is a lot. What percentage would that be of our total gas supply? I don't know if there's a way to really compare it that way, but...
It's probably...
what is it replacing, I guess?
Well, ethanol is an interesting product because at one level, it's really a complement for gasoline because what it's replacing is MTBE, other additives that we'd use to either enhance octane, to oxygenate the fuel, whatever. So it is a substitute for that. So when we talk about a 10% blend, we're often talking not about ethanol replacing gasoline, but replacing other additives that are already there. When we start talking about larger blends, the E85 people hear about a lot, now we're talking about using ethanol as a substitute for gasoline.
Okay.
So it's an interesting product in that it serves both those roles depending on how much of it we're blending with the petroleum product.
Okay. So it would be hard to come up with a figures on that. Let's talk to Jenny in Tomahawk. Has a question for you. Jenny, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to question... or talk about whatever.
Sure.
The ethics of using food-producing land, capacity,
yeah,
to make ethanol for people to drive their cars and so forth when there are people in Sudan and other parts of the world who are starving to death. I mean, it doesn't seem...
I understand what you're saying there, and I think Randy does too. Thank you very much for calling, Jenny. And Randy, what do you?
Well, that's actually a big concern, not only in the United States. It's important to understand this is actually a global industry in terms of its growth as well. So it's a concern internationally. I guess a couple of points. This past year was probably the first year that we explicitly planted additional corn acres for the ethanol industry. So now we can actually talk about acres that probably wouldn't have been planted to that crop except to serve the ethanol industry. Prior to that, most of what was happening was we were using the relative excess supplies that we had left over from previous years. We often have between 1 and 2 billion bushels of corn left over at the end of any marketing year as we go into the next harvest. And initially, some of the focus was on trying to find a place for that. Now, could that have gone into the international food market? Possibly, but we weren't doing it. So there were other issues associated with why it wasn't being delivered somewhere else. It is an important issue. One thing I should point out, though, and this doesn't address the land issue directly, but it does address price, because the real concern a lot of people express now is in the food versus fuel debate, how high the price of corn, for example, is. We did some work here, and it's certainly true that ethanol has increased the price of corn nationally. But it's also true that most of the volatility we've seen this last year and the very high price levels were only partially attributed to ethanol production. A couple of things have happened. One is we've actually been exporting a lot of corn, and the reason is the dollar is very cheap relative to other currencies worldwide. And that means at any given U.S. price, corn still looks like a pretty good deal to some exporters. So exports of corn really haven't gone down yet as a result of ethanol production. Now, that could happen in the future, but that really hasn't happened yet. The dollar has kept us weak. The result is, with both ethanol demand and the export demand, and then demand for livestock food in the U.S., the price has responded to all of those things simultaneously. In addition, we've had much more active participation from the speculative community, large index funds and hedge funds, in trading the derivative markets, the futures markets for these corn and soybeans especially, but wheat also. And that's had a large price impact, and that's not really related to ethanol either. Our work suggests that in the current market environment, if we double ethanol production, the price of corn goes up about 25%. So we would have expected to see the price this year for corn of around $3.20 a bushel. And there's been times in the summer we were way over $4 a bushel.
Yeah. And when you think about corn as a product itself, corn syrup and so forth, I mean, it's really hard to find food products that don't have corn of some sort in them. Well, that's an exaggeration, but...
No, that's absolutely true. But it's also true that really it's not corn that we export to the third world as a food product. So the acreage issue really isn't about what we're doing with the corn. It's about whether something else should be produced that would be useful in these other environments.
Yeah. Thanks again, Jenny. Ken and Madison, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. My question is similar to the last caller's, but a little more general. I get the impression you just take it for granted that the entire corn ethanol fuel industry, which wouldn't exist except that it is very, very heavily taxpayer subsidized, that that's a good idea, and that all we really need to worry about are the fine points of when the price goes up or down, or how it affects the export markets. From a lot of reading and thinking I've done of this over the years, I and a lot of other people really question that whole premise. The energy ratio of what is required, all things considered, to produce corn ethanol is not good. At times it appears to have been negative. A lot of ethanol has been produced with an overall net loss of energy, and even at best it's not good. Whether additional acreage specifically for this has been done a lot so far isn't really the question. If this is going to exist in the long run, by the most elementary logic, it means that a lot of acreage that otherwise would have been available for pasture land or park land or any of a lot of other uses is instead going to be used to grow corn specifically for fuel. Do you ever stop and rethink this, or is it just a given that this whole project is splendid and we just ought to subsidize it as long as it takes to make it keep working, which may be forever?
Yeah, that's a very good question and one worth pondering, and I think Randy's got some pretty good responses to that. And Ken from Madison, you'll get a chance to hear what he's got to say right after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the economics of biofuels and bioenergy now with Professor Randy Fortenberry, director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute at the UW-Madison. Really pleased to have him along. And he's one of the people who's been involved in probably the largest federal grant in the history of UW-Madison to create a center to explore how to convert lots of things into biofuel for use in cars and power plants and a lot of other places as well. So I'm sure we'll talk a little about that as well. But you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And just before noon, Ken called from Madison, I thought, with a good question that related to corn as a use in ethanol and talking about, the research shows that we may even have a net loss in terms of energy when we're converting corn into ethanol. And you've had some time to think about it. What's your comment?
Well, Ken actually raises some very good points. And, his inference about my positivity before was related on these relatively narrow things we were talking about, job creation in rural communities and the price impact on corn. I don't think it's necessarily universally clear sailing as we go forward. There are a lot of challenges that we're going to have. The issue of the energy balance has been a controversial issue for quite a while. I think most Scientists agree now that it's positive, but it's quite small. So we're talking about, you know, a 20 or 25% energy boost relative to the energy we get out versus the energy we put in. Part of that calculation, though, is a function of where you start counting.
Mm-hmm.
Is it when the corn arrives at the ethanol plant? Is it when the corn's put in the ground? Is it when you build the equipment that's used to plant and harvest the corn? So some of the disagreement has been on where we actually start the counting. Ken is right that this is an industry that's been heavily supported by public policy. There are some financial subsidies that exist. The subsidy at the national level is actually a blending credit, so it doesn't go to the ethanol plant directly, but people that blend ethanol with gasoline have a 51-cent blending credit in the form of a tax incentive that probably gets passed back to the ethanol price, so the price is higher than it would be without that. That's all true. I think as we look long-term, I don't believe corn-based ethanol is, in fact, the alternative energy of the future. It happens to be the alternative energy of the present because we know how to do it, and people are starting to get interested in talking about alternative energy. One thing, I don't know if this goes to Ken's question, but one thing that's important that you might come out away with the way Ken asked his question is, what about consumption? It's absolutely true that corn-based ethanol is not going to make us independent of petroleum. In fact, no feedstock we have today in the United States can take us there. So if we're really talking about energy independence, the consumption side has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed aggressively. The reason I don't think corn-based ethanol is really the alternative fuel of the future is, as we start to learn how to take other biomass sources and extract energy from those, corn will show itself to be too expensive and too energy inefficient in a sense. However, I do think there'll be a corn-based ethanol industry that survives beyond where we are today. The question is, what's the growth potential in that industry vis-a-vis the growth potential using these other biofuel sources, biofuel feedstocks? It's absolutely true, again, though, that if we're looking about energy independence and we're concerned about bringing in fragile lands back into row crop production that we once took out of row crop production, the consumption side has to be addressed as well.
Yeah, it sure does. And when you think about other fuels, switchgrass is one that I've heard mentioned, and I certainly have heard of forest byproducts. And we're a big forestry industry.
Yes, we are.
State.
And we know technically that all those have potential. What we haven't arrived at yet is a commercially viable way to extract energy and get it put on the market. Again, Ken's right that we've subsidized corn-based ethanol, but we've also subsidized gasoline as a petroleum product. So you often get into debate with the people that think we're moving too quickly in this direction and the people that don't think we're going fast enough about which subsidy is bigger and which one is more negative from a social perspective.
Ken, I thank you again for calling, and Robert in Coloma will give you a chance. Hi, Bob.
Hello. Hello to both of you. I'd like to continue on the ethanol. On Wisconsin Public Radio recently, two different experts stated that if all of the corn currently grown is turned to ethanol, it would only provide about 5 to 10% of that of the fuel needed. It's a small percentage. The other comment I'd like to have the guest make is on the use of rapeseed oil, which I understand they're doing in Europe, so-called canola oil.
Yeah,
that's a very good point. Well, on the gasoline side, I'm not sure what they meant by all fuel consumption. If we looked at just gasoline, so let's ignore diesel, jet fuel in the United States, if we devoted half of our corn crop to just ethanol production with the yields we had today, that would be probably a little less than 15% of total gasoline consumption. So now, how do you get down to 5%? Maybe they're talking about our larger fuel consumption, which would include diesel as well, which is what a lot of the commercial traffic, of course, uses as a transportation fuel. The canola oil you're talking about is an excellent question. It actually is used to make biodiesel, which is an alternative to diesel, petroleum diesel fuel. Like ethanol, it can get blended in various ratios to petroleum diesel. In the United States right now, the focus tends to be on soybean oil because we grow so many more soybeans than we do canola. Worldwide, there's been a huge increase in palm plantings in Indonesia, for example, because palm oil actually has a very attractive yield relative to many of these other oil crops we talk about. So we see places in other parts of the world where people are focusing on alternative feedstocks for the biodiesel production. Just here in Wisconsin, we have a plant that went online this year that's actually using, as part of their feedstock base anyway, recycled grease from restaurants and the byproducts of rendering plants. So biodiesel has the opportunity now to use actually some waste streams as well. But that's what the canola is being focused on in Europe. They produce rapeseed canola more efficiently than they do soybeans, and that's why that's their primary feedstock. They're also, by the way, a much larger percentage of their personal automobile fleet is diesel. Hmm. So biodiesel is more important to them than ethanol or some alternative to gasoline. And there's actually places in Europe where they have a very high requirement for the ratio of biodiesel to petroleum diesel in the transportation fuel stream.
Bob, thank you very much. Jackie and Ashland, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Well, my goodness, this is so timely. I was driving along and I had to find a phone just to let the general public know in, up here in the Ashland area that Tuesday the League of Women Voters is sponsoring a seminar on biodiesel fuel and the impact on the community. And I don't have my press release with me right now, but they're having, you know, speakers and people from the community and farmers from the community. And this is a program that we've been planning for a while. It'll be at the Great Lakes Visitor Center on Highway 2.
Mm-hmm.
But
nice
I have
place.
I have another question. I had heard that at some point sunflowers were going to be considered as biodiesel source. And I noticed up here in the Ashland area there are fields of sunflowers. And I was wondering if that's part of the study of having sunflowers as a biodiesel fuel.
Well, there are people looking at that. If you mean the study, I guess I don't know which specific study you might be talking about. There are people in the Dakotas where sunflowers are grown quite aggressively, as well as canola, by the way, that are looking at crushing opportunities to extract the oil for a biodiesel product. Essentially, any virgin vegetable oil that we can extract can be used as a feedstock for a biodiesel product. What makes one feedstock better than another one is the quality of oil that we extract and the yield you get the fuel yield you get from that original feedstock. Sunflowers certainly are being looked at, and they have potential to be a feedstock.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very, very much for calling, Jackie. Appreciate it. Tom in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My name is Tom, like you said, in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I am a member of the Milwaukee Biodiesel Co-op. We just started operations about 3 months ago or so. So we are a little bit behind the Prairie Fire co-op in Madison, but we're trying to catch up quickly. And currently we only have about 25 cars running through the co-op. Madison has about 250, and we're trying to bring this to the Milwaukee area for individual cars and as a resource, as an educational, promotional co-op for the localities and for the legislature. One of our issues is that in Minnesota, 2% of all the diesel for all diesel is biodiesel as a lubricant and to promote the alternative energy agenda. Currently, one of my questions is, where do we stand in the legislature here in Wisconsin on that, and if what are the roadblocks to initiating that agenda? That's one of my questions. And then I want to get into the carbon footprinting of biodiesel compared to ethanol. And it's quite a bit better. I'm sure your expert here on the line knows that, but I want to talk about those two subjects.
Okay, go ahead, Randy.
Well, I don't know if I have a good answer for you at the legislative side. There has been, and I saw this maybe a month or 5 weeks ago, and it's the last thing I've seen, legislation that was being that was going to be introduced, I believe, to the Assembly, but I think it was focused more on the ethanol side. There is a member of it. There's, of course, the an alliance that's been formed among biodiesel and ethanol producers, biofuel producers and distributors that has as its agenda item visiting with legislators and talking to them about what they think the appropriate public policy strategies are. I don't have a good answer for you, though, on exactly where that sits at the legislative level at this point. In terms of thinking about the energy yield, it's true that the energy yield of biodiesel is higher than the energy yield of ethanol. So as we look at converting a raw feedstock to biodiesel, the feedstocks that we use typically have a significantly higher energy yield than the feedstocks we use for ethanol.
Right. the information I have from the Department of Energy and Department of Ag is 3.24 times percent of diesel, gasoline, and I'm assuming ethanol, because they're all approximately the same thing. So it's three times better. So, but all the talk is continually about ethanol all the time, when you've got a product that's out there that could be used, at least in the trucking industry, that's way better because of that, because it's a crop that can be grown locally. You can extract much more oil from a soybean plant relative to its total biomass compared to ethanol, where you're only just getting off the kernels. So I just...
I understand your point. I think, and if you look at Europe, it's the other way around. And I think what's driven that is how we fuel our personal transportation fleet primarily. And in the United States, it's largely gasoline. You're absolutely correct about the commercial fleets. And in fact, where you're from in Milwaukee, I think they use biodiesel now in the bus services, the city bus system. There's a lot of public fleets around the United States that have at least adopted a blend of biodiesel in their overall transportation fuel. But again, I think the big push for ethanol was looking at the large consumption of gasoline. Even Minnesota, that you mentioned, who does have this 2% mandate, if you look at their public policies for ethanol, they were way ahead of that on the ethanol side. They've had a mandate there for a long time. They actually were actively involved in helping the development of plants initially, and they probably have a 15 or 16-year history of being involved in ethanol production, where their biodiesel public policy initiatives are much newer than that.
Interesting. Thanks, Tom. Thanks very much for calling. I did want to mention, I hope you stay listening, that there's a new two-year program, education program, aimed at working professionals in the biotech industry, and it's a master's program in biotechnology. I want to get the exact title here. Tell you what, it's a cross-training program, the Master of Science in Biotechnology. I wanted to mention that. It's a two-year program, and you're going to have farmers and doctors and scientists and business entrepreneurs all involved in this program. And not only some of them will be taking it, and there will be others who will be involved in the instruction of it. It's a hands-on program, solving strategies for virtually every related field, from science, law, and medicine to business ethics. So it sounds like an interesting program. Kurt Zimmerman, KJ Zimmerman at WISC.edu is the email address for Kurt. It's KJ Zimmerman at WISC.edu. Or you could phone Kurt at area code 608-262-0685, 262-0685, for some more information on this Master of Science in Biotechnology. Sounds like an interesting program. Rick in Sturgeon Bay, I think it's your turn. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Getting back to the ethanol energy equation, I haven't heard people discuss the waste stream produced by these production plants, and I would think that the grain that's been enhanced with yeast ought to be a good cattle feed.
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. We do produce a significant amount of distiller's grains. That's what the waste stream is called. It is a good cattle feed. There are challenges feeding it to other species, however. So, for example, if you're a hog producer, it's not necessarily a good feed source. And what we found is some controversy between the livestock industry and the grain industry over the use of corn because of its reduction then as an available feed source for some species. For cattle, that's not the case. In fact, we use it for dairy cattle. We use it for beef cattle, both. It does require some adjusting of the rations that are fed, but that has been done successfully. And in fact, in some parts of the country, what we've seen are people trying to build integrated operations where they have an ethanol plant, and they also are going to have some sort of a feed lot or some other animal production facility associated with that to use that product directly. But another thing that's actually being looked at now more aggressively is using that as an energy source at the ethanol plant itself. Right now, when we dry, most places anyway, the distiller's grain down to a moisture level that allows us to store it and transport it efficiently longer distances, we use a lot of natural gas. And one question is, can we use some of that distiller's grain itself directly as a fuel at the plant and replace some of the other fuel sources that are currently being used there?
Interesting. Thanks again, Rick, for calling. Wayne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. two things, one about the oil and one about the biodiesel. What portion of the oil that we use is actually used in power plants?
That's a good question, and I don't know what the answer to that is.
Okay, because here's the situation. We import oil and then burn it to make electricity.
Yes, sometimes.
It seems to be an awful waste. You take other countries like, now we developed nuclear in this country. We don't build any plants, we just build them for other countries. Now, France, as an example, is 70% of their power is nuclear. Japan, that was hit in anger, which should maybe not like nuclear, has 30% of their power nuclear. But we don't build any plants for ourselves. We'd rather import the oil.
And I actually, just as an aside, I've got my issue of Newsweek magazine this week. And yesterday, as a matter of fact, so last night about 10 o'clock, I was looking at it, and there was a quite a major article in there about the renewed interest in nuclear power in this country and the fact that they're starting to ramp up public opinion toward more nuclear. That's just an aside. Randy, you want to comment on Wayne's comments?
Yeah, I don't know how much petroleum product gets used directly to produce electricity or other power generation type activities. It is true that almost all the focus until just recently, meaning in the last couple of years, has been on the replacement of transportation fuels. I don't know why that is necessarily, yeah, except that we consume a lot of transportation fuels. It's also true that even when we don't use petroleum directly, though, in a power plant, let's say it's a coal-based plant, we use petroleum to get the coal to the plant. So It's absolutely true that it's been a major input to the production of energies beyond just transportation fuels, but I don't really have a good number for you on what the split is across different uses in the United States of petroleum products themselves.
Yeah. Thanks, Wayne, for calling. Bob in Claybanks, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I had two questions. I'm not sure if you can answer the first one, but I wondered about using biodiesel in fuel oil furnaces. And if you don't know about that, if you could refer a source that might know.
I don't have a source off the top of my head. That is a possibility. In fact, often it depends on the quality of the heating oil that's being used, but heating oil is basically a diesel product. So it is a possibility. When I actually did a study on the feasibility of a biodiesel plant in Wisconsin before we had one in place, and one of the things I looked at was not just replacing transportation fuel, but also looking at heating oil as a possibility. I can't give you a good answer about the technology that's required, like what does the furnace unit have to have in terms of any sort of a fuel-enhancing apparatus or anything like that. Right now, one of the challenges with biodiesel is it's quite expensive. So we do find a significant demand center of people that have diesel automobiles that feel that this is a socially responsible fuel to use. But in terms of heating homes at the current price, I suspect it would be a bit of a challenge to replace a lot of the heating oil that's being used.
Mm. And they, you know, the new research project that we have on the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences campus, they may have some additional information on that. I believe there's a website, and I'm trying to remember, or if it's just not quite up yet. I'm not sure.
There is a website at the College of Ag and Life Sciences, and unfortunately, I can't remember the exact URL. But it's a Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative, and it does list there both ongoing research projects, references to materials that have already been developed, both on the technology side, the social side, the economic side. I just don't know if there's anything there about heating oil.
But there are some good information. There are some good information people over there. And I think if you go to that Wisconsin Bioenergy Initiative website, you'll get a source. You'll get the communications person who's kind of in charge there, and she may well be able to give you some information on that, or somebody else connected with it.
Great. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
Is rapeseed less pesticide and herbicide intensive to grow than soybeans?
That's a good question, and I don't have a good answer for you because I think it depends on two things. One, what geographical part of the world you're talking about, and secondly, whether you're talking about rapeseed or canola. Canola is a rapeseed, but it's a specific variety. I think it is, but I should be careful about saying that because I'm not an agronomist and I'm not 100% sure that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. It grows very well in places like Saskatchewan, for example.
Yeah, it's the primary oilseed crop of Canada, for example, yeah.
And so it grows well there, and I'm pretty sure it grows well in the Dakotas, too.
We grow in the Dakotas. We grow in Montana. We grow a little bit in the southeastern part of the United States. It's quite adaptable, it appears, to various geographies.
And so as we look at this, Randy, we're about out of time here. The economics of biofuels is, you know, a lot of this is still up in the air, and we know a lot about the current economics of it, but those economics you would hope would change for the better even than they are now with future research.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of important points. Ken kind of made this point early on with one of his questions, which is the level of public support that we've provided to get the industry going. Now, again, one of the rationalizations for that is we've also supported the oil refining industry and extraction industry for some time. So maybe we're just trying to put them on the same footing, although both sides would disagree about whether that's actually happened or not. Right now, these products and biodiesel with the current price of at least vegetable oil as a feedstock really doesn't price itself competitively into the transportation fuel stream. So that's why people are interested in public policy. They think we should be doing this. And the last thing is, It is a very dynamic industry from technology perspective.
And we'll talk about this some more in coming months. Randy Fortenberry, director of the Rank Agribusiness Institute, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network.